Under the radar means hearing about things you didn't know you needed to know until you hear them.
It's a serious look.
You hear about the issues that don't get the attention they deserve.
Under the radar doesn't get caught up in the day-to-day.
Surfacing issues that are not talked about in mainstream media.
I think it's something that connects us to each other.
Under the radar is all about discovery.
I can be guaranteed voices I haven't heard before.
But also the questions.
Under the radar is one step ahead.
I'm Callie Crossley. This week on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. From the 1500s through the Civil War, more than 10 million black men, women, and children were enslaved in this country. Slavery deemed them property. They were listed on bills of sale, their family members sold away, their names changed. After emancipation and the Civil War, the formerly enslaved found many of the familial threads of connection buried or lost. It's why their African American descendants have difficulty tracing their lineage. Now a local organization is leading a national collaborative project to identify each of the 10 million.
You're about to hear about a groundbreaking initiative that seeks to identify our 10 million ancestors by their given names.
Later in the show, a special cultural event of music and theater native to the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico is headed to Boston.
It's not ours. It's not Agora's. It's not mine. It's for all Puerto Ricans to use and have it as a tool to connect with each other.
Bori Corridor will highlight the Boricuan or Puerto Rican experience through jazz and comedy in its inaugural tour of the Northeast. But first, joining me in the studio, Dr. Kendra Tara Field, Chief Historian of 10 Million Names, Associate Professor of History and Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. Hello, Dr. Field.
Hello, it's good to be with you.
Also with me, Richard Cellini, founding director of the 10 Million Names Project, director of the Harvard Slavery Remembrance Program, and founder of the Georgetown Memory Project. Hello.
I'm so happy to be here with you.
And Danielle White, vice president of strategic initiatives and community engagement at the Salt Lake Tribune, who has been tracing her Black family history for the last 6 years. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So first, let's start at the beginning with you, Richard, because this grew out, this national collaborative project grew out of what was known as and what is known as the Georgetown Memory Project, which is connected to Georgetown University's sale of enslaved people. In total, 314 individuals comprising 49 families were sold in 1838. This was obviously to buttress the financial well-being of the university.
Today, the Society of Jesus, who helped to establish Georgetown University and whose leaders enslaved and mercilessly sold your ancestors, stands before you to say that we have greatly sinned and we are profoundly sorry.
As many of my listeners will know, many universities now are taking a look at that history and what it means. But this particular project, the 10 Million Names, grew out of that. You were very much a part of that project, and you made the connection that was important to lead us to 10 Million Names. So what was the question that you asked after being a part of the Memory Project? And give us a little bit about what that Memory Project was about.
Sure. The Georgetown Memory Project, as you mentioned, was an independent research initiative designed to identify more than 300 enslaved people sold by Georgetown University in 1838 and to trace and identify all of their direct descendants living and deceased. I'm a Georgetown alumnus. I went to college and law school there, but I always say, you know, I went to Georgetown, but I'm not responsible for what goes on there. And I say that because I got started in this in sort of an unusual way. I'm not African American. I'm white. I live in the Northeast. I'm just an Eisenhower Republican, a businessman. Really didn't know much about the history of slavery or African American history. But Georgetown announced that it was setting up a working group to look into this 1838 slave sale. So I sent an email to a very senior member of the Georgetown Working Group, and I just asked one question. And actually, my question had nothing to do with Georgetown. My question was, if Georgetown sold more than 300 people in 1838, what happened to them? What happened to the people? A few hours later, I got an email back from the senior working group member who said, Dear Richard, Georgetown looked into this just a couple of years ago, and what we discovered was that they all immediately died of a fever in the malodorous swamp world of Louisiana. And, you know, I took a look at that email and I thought, even the Titanic had survivors. It's just not possible that that happened. So I hired a group of genealogists and started the Georgetown Memory Project, and roll it forward 8 years now. We have fully identified 242 of the more than 300 enslaved people and traced and verified more than 10,000 of their direct descendants. It was life transforming for many of the people in what's known as the GU 272 descendant community. And I realized that while in one sense the GU 272 are very special, in another sense, their situation is like millions of African-American people living today. I mean, the same methodologies we applied to the Georgetown community could be applied to all 10 million people who were enslaved in the United States between 1565 and 1865.
So that would mean a lot more people are out there unidentified, hence now 10 million names, looking for those folks. Like, where are they? What happened to them? How to name them?
Yeah. I mean, there were 10 million people enslaved in what is now the United States between 1565 and 1865. And of the 44 million Americans living today identifying as Black, probably 42 million of them are the direct descendants of somebody who was enslaved.
So Dr. Field, Richard comes up with this question. Now we're thinking about what happens to them. And suddenly all wheels are turning about how to expand what was happening with the Georgetown Memory Project to really look at all of the folks that were lost in this brutal system, which was set up intentionally to obscure the kind of details that might allow people to find out what happened to their ancestors. So talk a little bit about why it has always been tough to identify folks who were enslaved.
Sure. Well, you know, the institution of slavery as it developed in the United States was really built upon the separation of families, to be sure. About one in three enslaved African Americans were separated from an immediate loved one, a child, a parent, a sister, a brother, a husband, a wife. And that separation obviously interrupts the transmission of family knowledge. But on top of that, for a great portion of the history of slavery, there was also value placed on really preventing the transmission of that knowledge. So Frederick Douglass talked about not knowing his birthday, not being allowed to know his birth date, and many, many other lesser known enslaved individuals, daughters and sons and parents were prevented from or separated from familial knowledge. Now, that being said, what I work on in my own scholarship is the kind of long history of African American genealogy. The fact that in spite of and in some cases because of that attempt to erase or obscure familial knowledge, Africans and African Americans who were enslaved in the land that became the United States doubled down on their efforts to maintain or recover that information. So there's a long history beginning with the Middle Passage going forward of people of African descent in this country engaging in what we would now call genealogical work, the transmission of familial knowledge. And so I often talk about the fact that 10 million names is joining a very long and rich tradition that, you know, started as early as the Middle Passage. There's records of parents and children sharing family history under the cover of night behind closed doors. And when I say records, I mean oral histories for the most part, although some letters, family documents, objects, right? Ways in which information was passed down in spite of and against those odds.
Well, and we've seen since then, if people may recall Alex Haley's book, Roots, which was quite a sensation at the time of its publication and then was made into a couple of television series. He was able to trace his family roots because at every generation, they passed on certain words that allowed him, when he was began the process of looking back, to take those words and put it together.
Every time this African would point to this instrument with his daughter in tow, he would say to her, "Ko," as if it was spelled K-O, a single syllable. And the little girl, Kizzy, came to know that in her African father's terms, that stringed instrument meant ko. There were numerous other sounds for other objects that he would point out from time to time.
So without having those little connective tissue pieces, he might have had more difficulty in trying to make that happen. So, Danielle, you're doing exactly the work that Dr. Field is talking about and that Richard wanted to see happen with the descendants of the folks who were enslaved by Georgetown University. You've been looking into your family history, and in your case, you have a really stark example of the difference in what it takes to find out history on the Black side, because you have a parent who is not Black, and or you have a relative who is not Black, and so therefore you saw the difference. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, it's a pretty stark difference. I'm biracial, though I identify primarily as a Black woman. My mother's side of the family was white, and also members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church. And the Mormon Church is very big into genealogy and passing down that knowledge of our ancestors to the next generation. And so I remember being very small with my grandparents, going through generations and generations and generations of my ancestors. I know one ancestor was a member of the Royal Guard in Sweden, and I know the root of their last name and what that means, and it was named after a mountain, right? But then I don't know my lineage beyond my great-grandparents on my dad's side of the family.
And what did you run into as you began to try to research that?
Well, lots of dead ends, unfortunately. Either just no record of what happened or where they were born, different name spellings, because often they weren't literate or didn't have someone who would, you know, stick with the spelling of the correct name. My great-grandmother's name is Pakola. It's spelled about four different ways in records. It's very hard. And with a name like White, it's very common. And so you can't always discern who is who and if that indeed was the right person you're looking for. So it's a lot of searching through records, making guesses, lots of dead ends. And of course, so my great-grandmother, on my dad's mother's side, was born into slavery. Her mother was sold just a few years before emancipation. No one knows what happened to her. Her last name changed. We don't know where she was sold to, if it was within the state of Texas, outside of it. There's just no record of her. And that, you know, that case happens over and over in the different corners of my family history.
So one of the things that you mentioned to my producer is that you hit the 1860s and then, you know, you just, there was a block. And Dr. Field, I've heard you say there's something called the 1870 block because it gets more difficult then. And would you explain why and why that particular period of time?
Sure. So 1870 is the first year, the first decade really that the federal government through the census begins to take note of people who were formerly enslaved by name in a systematic way. So the 1870 federal census, and as your listeners may know, in every 10 years, the federal government does the census. So from 1870 onward, we have access to names for the most part. Although, you know, as Danielle points out, they often do change over time. Prior to 1870, there's no such comprehensive source. And often genealogists refer to 1870, therefore, as 1870 brick wall. However, there are many other places we can go prior to 1870. In addition to oral history, there are written records. And some of these, you know, there's different kind of categories of these records form the basis of kind of how we approach our methodology within 10 million names. So, for instance, records of Black soldiers in the American Revolution and in subsequent wars up through the Civil War are quite detailed. We have pension records relating to those wars as well. And we also have records from private places, including plantations, ledgers that named people who were enslaved individually throughout the history of slavery. Some of these remain in private hands. Some of them have become publicly available. We have remembrances of slavery. We have interviews conducted with former slaves, you know, from the mid-19th century through the mid-20th century and even beyond in a couple of cases. And so there are lots of places we can go to find those names, and that people have been going for generations, researchers, as well as descendants. And part of the goal of 10 million names is to form a sort of clearinghouse through which this information is more accessible to the general public. So that you might go to the database and be able to, you know, kind of essentially pass forward into another pre-existing source that may have always been there, but that wasn't connected to another set of records. And so we're really kind of trying to corral all the available information out there to get to that 10 million.
Richard, talk about all the partnering that's happening, beginning with American Ancestors, which is right here in Boston. They've been doing this genealogical research work for quite some time. They're leading the collaborative effort. But there are many partners to pull together, as Dr. Field has said, to then put into this database, at the end of which one hopes all the many, many more names will have been identified.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's called the 10 Million Names Project. But it's really not a project. It's more like a movement or a community or an ecology. I mean, there's no sense whatsoever that the 10 Million Names Project and American Ancestors is just going to sort of magically do this in isolation and hand it down to the world as their gift to civilization. This is going to take everybody. And I literally mean everybody. It's going to take community volunteers, learned societies, local county historical organizations, genealogical associations, museums, universities, colleges. And really, a big part of the work of the 10 Million Names Project is creating that community and creating a comfortable, workable ecology for people to collaborate so they can do this work together. This work could take, you know, years or decades, and we welcome everybody's help. There's a lot of work to be done.
Danielle, back to you. You learned about 10 million names at the National Association of Black Journalists, as I did, and you were already in process. How did it help you be a part of this, what we've now described as this collaborative effort, to end up with a really workable database that has a lot of information, including your family history?
Yeah, I was thrilled to hear about the project in the opening session at NABJ. And I think I was in my seat during opening session on my phone and created an appointment right there. I was so excited to have the opportunity to speak with someone. And, you know, it's a half hour session, but what she was able to help me find really kind of unlocked something that I had been stuck on for a long time. And so that's the fact that my great-great-grandmother that I mentioned before, who we lost a record of her, I was looking at the particular city of Longview, Texas, thinking it was, you know, the records were in this particular county. She helped me find out that the name of the county actually was not what it currently is. And so I had been looking in the wrong county for these records. And yes, I will have to continue to look through slavery ledgers. And I don't have her exact birthday. So oftentimes it's just their sex and their age. And I don't know her exact age in a given year. So it's still going to be a long process, but she showed me how to use the tools to find things and try different approaches and think a little bit outside of the box and remember that just because, you know, this is how it is now isn't how it was before. And that really helped me. We had a very emotional moment together, and I really just appreciated, you know, that time with her.
And again, that was American Ancestors based right here in Boston, working, leading this collaborative effort. Now, when you talk about the emotion of connecting with this information, there's a good example of it often in the series Finding Your Roots, which is hosted by Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, who is also an advisory board member to 10 Million Names. Here's former CNN host Don Lemon on his program getting the information from Dr. Gates.
Her four children, Catherine, 6, Mary, 4, Eliza, 2, and an infant at $1,800. That was their worth?
Right.
This was their slaves. That's my family. That's where I came from.
So much of the information and the tracing has to do with property values. So as former CNN host Don Lemon was learning there that his family members were considered property, and often in the tracing of this lineage, the most important documentation comes from bill of sales because they were very careful, these quote-unquote owners, to make sure that the property was detailed, Dr. Field.
Absolutely. So, you know, any good historian will learn to kind of follow the money, follow the property, right? And because enslaved people were counted as property, ironically, we do have access to more sources than we would have otherwise, right? In some cases, very detailed information about transactions on which people's lives and their family relations were on the line. An individual auction, right, of enslaved mothers and fathers and children, right, can be an incredible source of information to present-day descendants as to where their ancestors began and where they ended up, how they were separated, whether they reunited. We sometimes even find that information. At the same time, I will say that the qualitative information about how people lived, loved, labored, formed and maintained and relationships against the odds, some of the most valuable information on that front comes from subsequent remembrances, right? The interviews conducted oftentimes at historically Black colleges and universities like Fisk University and Hampton in the late 19th century, that can be incredibly valuable to get to really that emotional piece that you're describing, right? To give people a sense of what their ancestors' lives actually consisted of beyond that number, beyond property value.
Well, that leads me to the question that some may be asking as they hear this conversation. I want each of you to talk about the bigger point of building this database, the bigger point of starting this project is really not necessarily just about the numbers. I mean, obviously the numbers are important because we want to be reminded that there were 10 million people and that there are, as Richard has pointed out, 42 living descendants, probably directly related to some of those 10 million. But there's more going on here in terms of America's story and then certainly in terms of Black America's story. So I'd love each of you to respond to that. Like Richard, as you said at the beginning, you never imagined you'd be getting into the throes of a project like this, and yet here you are. And what have you come to take away from the importance of this, why this project is so important?
Well, you know, a lot of people like to talk about this project during in February, during Black History Month. And I often say, well, you know, this is white history, too. In fact, it's pretty hard to tell the history of slavery without talking about the white folks and their involvement. So this is not Black history, and it's not white history. This is American history. And I always say to people, you know, if you love American history, Black history is just more of what you love, because Black history is American history, and American history is Black history. This is really the story of all of us, and it also helps us to understand that there is no us and them in America. There's only us, and it's always been that way.
And Danielle, you said you felt as though before really getting into doing this work, and certainly now with the help of the 10 Million Names Project, that your family story was just incomplete, and that felt wrong to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's very imbalanced. I can trace back my lineage on one side of the family generations, and I can understand where certain attributes or beliefs have been passed down. But it's not the same on my other side of the family. And that, you know, personally outrages me. It makes me feel incomplete. It makes me feel like there's just a disparity. It's very unfair that I have that information and that piece of my identity and on one side and not the other. And so from a personal aspect, that's where I'm coming at this from. I'm almost doing this for sake of justice.
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and I'm here with Dr. Kendra Tara Field, Chief Historian of 10 Million Names, Richard Cellini, Founding Director of the 10 Million Names Project, and Danielle White, tracing her Black family history. We're talking about the 10 Million Names Project. Dr. Field, so you, as Chief Historian, get to oversee this project, but you can come at it from different ways. As you've said, you've researched your own family history. You also, these are methodologies about researching family history and genealogy that within the context of historical research you've taught. But here you are deeply involved in what is really a daunting task of trying to begin to identify all these folks. So, you know, I really want to hear from you about the larger purpose and mission of it, because it's, as I said, more than just putting numbers in the database.
The notion of, you know, what some psychologists call intergenerational identity, I think, is at the core of this. It's something that I think we know much more intuitively without that phrase, but the idea that children know that there's part of something bigger, right? Part of a bigger story, part of a larger whole. Psychologists have determined time and again now that, you know, there's a direct correlation to children's resilience, that in the face of difficulty or other kinds of challenges, having a sense of where one comes from, where one's family comes from, can be a key determining factor in life outcomes. And I think that kind of finding has particular implications for African-American families and communities.
And just to emphasize your point, this is Good Morning America's co-anchor Michael Strahan, who traced the formerly enslaved members of his family to relatives living in Shankleville, Texas today.
A few years ago, researchers looked into my family tree, and those behind the groundbreaking 10 Million Names Project said it confirmed I was part of this community and its rich legacy. And it all began with Jim and Winnie Shankle.
I'm Loretha.
Loretha Higgins.
Here I am meeting my long-lost cousins, Loretha, Stephanie, Billy, and Philip, in the East Texas community of Shankleville.
I forgot about this Texas heat.
I mean, it's just so joyous, and it sort of underscores what you said, Dr. Field, about that resilience and that the importance of knowing that history and having that connection. The tagline for 10 Million Names is Recover, Restore, and Remember. And you said, Dr. Field, and also you, Richard, that you expect that initially there will be a lot of information that flows into the database because of not just interest, but some of the ongoing work by people like Danielle White. And then what do you expect to happen in terms of timing of this, or, I mean, this is a huge project, so no one expects 5 years from now you'll have all the names or even close to that. But what's your expectation or your hope, Richard, that how the database and the project will be at that point?
I think it'll be shaped like a hockey stick. I think the more information we have, the more information we'll generate. Initially, I think it will be populated, the database will be populated by the early adopters, if you will, who already have done their family history, and there are millions of people who have done that in the Black community. But those links will lead us to other links and yet more links, and I'm hoping for an exponential growth in the database. Look, we're building a cathedral here. This could take decades, but it doesn't have to feel like a slog. I think a lot of this can sort of go viral. As I said, this is a community effort. This will take everybody, and the more nodes of information we create, the easier it will be for people in the community to connect with this vast network of 10 million people who are enslaved.
Danielle, how do you respond to what is an overt, some would call it a movement, I'll say effort, in several states and other communities to just stop the teaching of African American history? And as you look at 10 million names and the mission of it, of course, this is very much African-American history. As Richard has said, it's also white history. But there are people that believe that this should not be taught, that's somehow offensive to other Americans who are not African-American. So what say you to that and this moment in time?
Yeah, I agree with Richard's point that Black history is American history. And if you're going to teach children history, you need to teach all of it, the whole picture. And it really only hurts them and the future of our country, right? History repeats itself. We can't avoid making the mistakes of the past or try to rectify the mistakes of the past if we're not aware of them. And so I just think it really does a disservice to all involved of every race. And it's pretty myopic in its viewpoint.
Dr. Field, the future of 10 million names as you see it.
Yeah, I mean, I repeat this ad nauseum, but in many ways, this is not new. What's new is kind of the kind of confluence of technology and resources and the collaborative effort. And so, I mean, I think we're at a really powerful and beautiful moment of great potential and possibility. If we can come together with collaborators and share what we know, a lot of this information is hiding in plain sight. And as we bring together the tools of historians and genealogists and descendants, I think we have a great future ahead.
Well, thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
So good to be here. Thanks for including me.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kendra Tara Field is the Chief Historian of 10 Million Names, Associate Professor of History, and Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. Richard Cellini is the Founding Director of the 10 Million Names Project, Director of the Harvard Slavery Remembrance Program, and Founder of the Georgetown Memory Project. And Danielle White is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Community Engagement at the Salt Lake Tribune, who has been tracing her Black family history for the last 6 years. Coming up, Puerto Ricans are also known as Boricuans, which simply means people who come from the island. With a nod to the indigenous language, organizers are kicking off the Bori Corridor inaugural tour. The arts and media event celebrating Puerto Rican culture will travel to communities with significant Puerto Rican populations in Boston and the Northeast. That's next. This is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley.